Chapter 16. February 1st, 2014. My alarm went off in a whisper, set to the lowest possible volume, and still I flew out of bed to tap it silent. I held my breath and peered into the darkness until I could make out the shape of David, sprawled in the beanbag chair. He hadn't stirred at the sound. I breathed again. My hours had changed dramatically since I started my new job. When I worked at Cubby's, I seldom made it home before 5, and I'd usually find David already asleep. But now I tried to be in bed by 11, and he was never home at that hour. That first night he stumbled home at 2 and couldn't find his key, or maybe he couldn't find the keyhole. He yelled, "Open the fuck up!" and pounded the door so hard it rattled. I hurried to let him in, but not before he woke most of the other tenants in our building. They swarmed the hall in various stages of dress, all of them upset and clamoring for silence. One of them called the cops. I made David hide under the bed when the officers rang the bell, and I answered the door and apologized for making so much noise. They gave me the once-over and sniffed my breath and warned me not to let it happen again. When they were gone, I whispered to David to come out, but he was already asleep. That was where he spent the night, on the floor under the bed. Ours was not the kind of neighborhood where you could leave your apartment door unlocked overnight. But after that incident, that was what I did. The first night I lay for hours with my eyes open and my fists clenched, ears straining for any sound of an intruder, until I finally fell into an exhausted sleep, so deep I didn't even hear David when at last he came home. So this was our new routine. The alarm went off at 6, I rolled over, and there David was, asleep in the chair. It was months since we last shared a bed, and many more months since we last made love. No, that wasn't right. It was months since we last had sex, years since we last made love. I slipped out of bed and tiptoed around him, and picked up the spoon he must have dropped on the floor. I turned on the oven, and when I looked back, I found him sprawled in the beanbag with a smile on his face, and the needle still in his arm. The shock slammed into me, and I froze there in the chilly kitchen. He'd never brought it home before, even in the early days when it was only coke. It was a workplace thing then, something to help him to supercharge his battery so he could power through the day. Cocaine was the young financier's drug of choice, and it carried none of the stigma of other drugs, not the meth upstate, nor the heroin downtown. It almost had a certain elite panache, like drinking Cristal. David would do a couple bumps during the day when the numbers were flying fast and furious, every deal bigger and more precarious than the last. I never needed it myself. The law was a more contemplative profession than finance. Poise was valued over speed. Yes, my ability to think on my feet was an asset, but the truth was, there were seldom any surprises in court. I already knew what the evidence would be, because I'd already exchanged all of it with my adversary. The surprises, when they came at all, came to the office, where I had time to react, to deliberate, to strategize. But even though I didn't indulge, I didn't object to David's use back then, so long as he didn't bring it home and he was careful about where he got it. And he was. His dealer was the compliance officer at his investment bank. He gave up cocaine after the fall, even though that was when he could have used the energy boost the most. Instead, his weed usage went up as he spent his days drifting between couch and bed. His alcohol usage went up too, as he spent his nights drifting between bed and couch. I could handle his drinking. I'd grown up with drunkards, and everybody I'd ever known had an alcoholic somewhere in their life. They dealt with it, and so could I. But then David started disappearing at odd hours of the night, and I started to notice things disappearing too. A piece of jewelry, the oil painting we bought from a shishi gallery in Soho, money from my wallet. For a long time, he let me pretend it was only alcohol he was abusing. He'd even slosh a little whiskey on his clothes for effect, sip a little to scent his breath. It was our unspoken pact. I'd enable his habit if he'd enable my pretense. He didn't bother anymore. He didn't try to hide it. But still, it was a jolt to see the truth laid out so starkly. I lifted his wrist and checked for a pulse and found it. He might be dead to the world, but he wasn't dead to me. Not yet, anyway. Carefully, I slid the needle from his vein and untied the rubber strap from his arm. I searched each of his pockets, and he didn't stir, even when I slipped my hand underneath him. In the back pocket of his pants, I found his stash, 3 little baggies of a fine powder. I flushed it down the toilet and wrapped the needle and strap in a garbage bag and put it by the door. I found his wallet in his other back pocket. There were only a few bills left in it, not enough to do any damage on their own, but I took them anyway. I'd started to put the wallet back when the photo sleeve fell open, and I got my second jolt of the day. My own face looked up at me. It was my last professional portrait, a head and shoulders shot in front of a shelf of law books, taken for the Jackson Reader's website. There I was, the golden girl of yore, wearing salon highlights and a theory suit and a supercilious smile. I hadn't realized he was carrying around this old photo. The discovery might have charmed me or made my eyes well up. But it didn't. It only made me jealous of that other girl, the one who didn't exist anymore, the only one he'd ever loved. I took the photo out and tossed the wallet on the floor. On my way out the door, I picked up the garbage bag and dropped it in a dumpster 2 blocks away. I threw the photo in after it. 1 month in, my routine was well established at CDMI. Every morning, I went to my own little office first, checked my voicemail and email for anything from Barrett or any company-wide blasts. Those were the only 2 possibilities. Got a cup of coffee, then took the stairs down to the document room. In my mind, I called it the lab. It was that sterile and that secret. According to Lester Willard, the paralegal come security guard, the room was to remain locked at all times. Only the 2 of us were permitted entry, and he had the only key. None of the documents were to be removed from the room. A copier stood in 1 corner of the vast white space, and all photocopying was to be done on that machine and that machine only. The same machine would be used for bait stamping, to place identifying numbers on the documents that eventually would be produced to Mark Ivins. On one of the tables was a computer for my use in indexing the documents. It was a standalone unit without Wi-Fi and not connected to the company LAN. The only other furniture in the room was a single chair on wheels for me to roll from table to table as I did my document review, and a stationary chair for Lester that he kept by the door. All the documents in the room, all those stacks of pure white papers, were photocopies. The first day I asked Lester where the originals were, and he replied, "I wouldn't know, ma'am," which soon became his default response to every question I asked. He worked the copier whenever I gave him a stack of documents, but otherwise he spent the day in his chair, reading the paper, and mostly watching me. He was my paralegal come babysitter. Some of the documents I'd seen before. They were copies of the original papers I'd found in the file boxes in my office the first day on the job. None of these elaborate security measures were in place then, probably because the boxes arrived without warning after Barrett was unexpectedly called to KL. It was pure accident that I'd stumbled upon them, and now I was glad I'd taken such care in resealing the boxes. It was obvious that Barrett considered them to be highly sensitive. My marching orders from Barrett were to identify any privileged or confidential documents among these towering piles of papers. The privileged documents were easy to spot, since they almost always involved communications to or from a lawyer. As soon as I developed a roster of pertinent lawyers' names, I was able to breeze through that part of the job. Identifying confidential employee information was a little harder, with thousands of people in the company's employ. But once I came upon the payroll records, I was able to create a database of employee names. All of this was routine work in preparing documents for production to a litigation adversary. But nothing about the lab and Lester was routine, and that tipped me off. There had to be something far more sensitive than attorney letters and employee records among these documents. One day last week, I thought I'd found it. I came upon a stack of employee medical records. Apparently, every new hire underwent a medical assessment upon arrival at PST to screen out any serious or infectious diseases. The doctor's notes were there, in English, listing DOB, height, weight, BP, temperature, pulse rate, respiration rate, then a handwritten OK to work. It was the DOB that jumped out at me. Some of them were as young as 10, yet the doctor's note was the same, OK to work. I cross-checked the children's names with the payroll records and confirmed it. Those children photographed in the dining hall at PST weren't family members of employees, as I'd thought. Or at least not only family members. They were employees, too. Okay, so CDMI used child labor. They weren't the first Western company to exploit Asian child labor, and the practice didn't violate any local laws. But it would be an enormous black eye for the company if the media found out. And I could see why Barrett was worried. More to the point, I could see that the medical records were not remotely responsive to Mark Ivan's document request. There was no legal requirement to produce these files to him, and hundreds of reasons not to. Hundreds of employees under the age of 16. So I pulled all the employee medical records, placed them in a box, sealed it, and told Lester to deliver it to Mr. Barrett, for his eyes only. I thought that might be the end of the DEFCON 1 level of secrecy. But the next day, I got an email from Barrett. Shay, good work flagging those confidential employee documents. Might still be more. Stay alert. Barry. Today, I discovered the real smoking gun. It was Saturday, but I came into the office anyway. I did every day. It was warm there, and the coffee and internet were free. Besides, there was nothing to do at home but worry about David if he wasn't there, and maintain silence if he was. Lester had agreed to come in on his day off, but not until after lunch. I couldn't work on the documents without my official escort into the lab, but I kept myself otherwise busy. I read the news online, focusing especially on the fashion features and anything coming out of Southeast Asia. I drafted some of the boilerplate language I would use in responding to Mark Ivins's document requests, and I updated the forms I'd developed during my time at Jackson Readers. I found some hanging file folders in the supply room and organized the drawers in my desk. In the bottom of one drawer, I found the documents I'd copied from the file boxes my first day on the job, the air charter contracts that had been misfiled with the asset sale documents. Also in that drawer was the legal pad containing the handwritten index of the boxed files I'd prepared that first day. As it turned out, it was a wasted effort, since I had to start from scratch to prepare the same index down in the lab. I tossed the legal pad in the wastebasket. But as the pages fanned out in a cascade of words and numbers, one of the entries caught my eye. I pulled the papers back from the trash. The notation was my summary of the sale of one of the real estate parcels at Paradis-sur-Terre. I'd listed the sale price as $2.4 million, but I felt certain the settlement sheet I'd seen in the lab listed it as $4.1 million. Maybe I was remembering wrong, but I didn't think so. Or maybe I'd made an error in the entry, either here or downstairs. But again, I didn't think so. I wasn't allowed to take any documents out of the lab, but nobody said I couldn't take any documents in. I photocopied my handwritten index, and when Lester called to let me know he'd arrived, I tucked the pages inside the waistband of my skirt. They crackled a bit as I walked downstairs to the lab, but Lester didn't seem to notice. He swiped his key card through the lock and let me in. I set him to work bait stamping a few thousand pages that I'd already cleared for production to Mark Ivins. Once he was occupied with the machine in the corner of the room, I pulled the photocopies from my skirt and smoothed them out on the table. Then I sat down at the computer and opened the document index I'd been creating here in the lab. It took only a moment to confirm that my recollection was correct. My handwritten notes showed proceeds of $2.4 million for that particular parcel of real estate. The entry on the computer screen showed proceeds of $4.1 million. I wheeled my chair across the room and located the settlement sheet for that transaction. The sale price that appeared there was also $4.1 million. Okay, I thought, so I made a mistake in my handwritten notes. But I didn't believe it. I did a side-by-side comparison of the index on the screen against my handwritten index. I went through every asset sale from PST, real estate, equipment, raw materials, and finished goods. In nearly every instance, my notes from the original documents in the file boxes showed a much lower sale price than the copies in the lab. A forklift sold for either $15,000 per my notes or $25,000 per the computer screen. A sewing machine for either $1,495 or $2,799. It went on and on. Cafeteria tables, trucks, air compressors, mattresses, cutting machines. All the sales proceeds were greater than what I'd recorded from the original documents in the file boxes. I scooted my chair across the room to the table, where the closing binders and bills of sale were stacked, and I double-checked the sales figures against those documents. They all matched the numbers I'd entered into the computer. So my mistake, if I'd made one, hadn't been made in the lab. But it wasn't one mistake. It would have been a mistake in recording the sale prices of literally hundreds of assets. One mistake I could admit, but 200? No. The documents in the lab were copies. The documents I'd indexed from the file boxes were originals. The conclusion was inescapable. Someone had altered the copies to inflate the sales proceeds of the PST assets. Madame de Martineau had boasted in her annual letter to the shareholders that CDMI had sold off the assets so successfully that it had turned the proverbial sow's ear into a silk purse. Somebody, at her behest or Barrett's, must have doctored the sales documents to support that boast. Reality check. CDMI couldn't just make up numbers. It was a publicly held company with certified public accountants doing regular audits. If there'd been a discrepancy between the reported sales proceeds and the actual monies received into the company's bank accounts, the auditors would have caught it. And the documents couldn't have been altered just for purposes of the lawsuit. Mark Ivins had access to the audited financials, and he'd catch any discrepancy too. That had to mean the company actually did receive the total amount it was claiming, but not from the asset sales in question. So what else did it sell to arrive at that silk purse? The answer was obvious. Drugs. Deep in the jungles of Myanmar, CDMI had turned to drug trafficking to save its bottom line. The idea wasn't far-fetched. That was exactly what John DeLorean was accused of doing years ago in a last-ditch effort to save his failing car company. CDMI could have used the drug proceeds to shore up its balance sheet, but it had to disguise the source of that money. So what it did was inflate the proceeds of its legitimate asset sales. Now I understood the lab and Lester and all the elaborate security measures. I stole a glance at him. He was still busy at the copier, but he clocked me with a sidewise glance as I wheeled my chair back to the computer. I picked up a random file and pretended to study it. I needed to look and act normal for his sake. I couldn't let him guess what I'd stumbled upon. He might very well have been part of the drug trafficking business when he was stationed in Southeast Asia. That would explain his assignment here. He'd know to be on the lookout, and he'd be especially vigilant where those doctored sales figures were concerned. Now I understood something else. Why, against all odds, I'd been hired. Barrett must have figured out how desperate I was for a job, and how desperate I'd be to keep it. He knew he could count on me to keep my mouth shut. I didn't go near the asset sales files for the rest of the day, but they weighed heavily in my thoughts. I was working for a drug trafficker, covering up for a drug trafficker. I tried to rationalize it away the same way I had when I discovered the company was exploiting child labor. I tried to convince myself that none of this was my problem. I hadn't doctored those documents, and no part of my assignment required me to examine the numbers. I wouldn't even suspect they'd been falsified if I hadn't accidentally stumbled on the file boxes that first day. My assignment was simply to flag the privileged and confidential documents and organize the rest for production. That was the extent of my job. That was what I was being paid for. And that was all I was going to do. It was snowing when I emerged from Marketplace Tower that night, and a couple inches already blanketed the pavement. Working all day in a windowless room made me oblivious to the weather until the cold reality struck. I flipped up the hood on my parka, but there was no way to protect my feet, and my pumps were sodden by the time I reached the station. My train was delayed, and I stood shivering on the platform for 20 minutes until it arrived. The heat wasn't working in my car, and my teeth were chattering by the time I reached my stop. I promised myself a hot bath the minute I got home, and I prayed the boiler wouldn't be on the fritz again. I got off the train and ran the rest of the way home and down the stairs to our apartment. I unlocked the door and hit the light switch and stopped dead on the threshold. The apartment had been ransacked. Drawers were upended and dishes flung into shards. The mattress was pulled off the bed and ripped open. Stuffing erupted from the gash. Some of the sheetrock had even been pried from the wall, exposing the studs and wiring and tufts of pink insulation. "We've been robbed," was my first panicked thought. But an instant later, I knew it wasn't true. No one could be desperate enough to rob the poorest people in New York. No, this was David's work. He'd been searching for his stash, or my cash. He'd done the same thing many times before, but this time was different. This time there was fury behind it. The only thing left untouched was the beanbag chair. He must have felt confident that I wouldn't be so bold as to hide anything in the very chair he was sleeping in. Or maybe he simply wanted to be sure he'd have a place to sleep when, if he came back. When he came back, I wondered if he'd still be in the rage that had caused all this destruction. Until now, even on our worst day, I'd never felt unsafe with him. I wondered if we'd finally crossed that line. I wondered if I should lock the door or go stay somewhere else. But I had nowhere else to stay, and neither did he. I picked up the broken crockery, slid the drawers back into the dresser and cabinets, hauled the mattress onto the bed, and pushed the stuffing back inside as best I could. When I went to bed, I left the door unlocked. Chapter 17. A sound mind in a sound body. Mrs. Casco's advice wasn't always original, but it was always valuable. Case in point, the better I got at books and exams in middle school, the more I tended to shut myself up in the library, and the less I tended to move. It was Mrs. Casco who made me get outside and run and play and try out for sports and work as hard at exercise as I worked at studying. She helped me out with uniforms and fees and rides to and from practice. And she sat in the bleachers and cheered me on through the seasons, from hockey to swimming to lacrosse, from JV to varsity to team captain and MVP. Thanks to the campus gyms at Brown and Columbia, I was able to keep it up through college and law school. And after that, I could afford to join the trendiest gym in Manhattan. I was in the best shape of my life on the day I lost my job. In my first year of poverty, I gained 10 pounds on cheap, starchy foods and lost all my muscle tone through lack of a gym. There was a reason why obesity was the scourge of the poor. Salvation came only when I took up running. I ran for miles, hours every day, through 3 of the 5 boroughs, through posh neighborhoods and poor, at all hours of the day and night. And I never once feared for my safety, because I knew I could outrun anyone who might threaten me. These were the thoughts roiling through my mind while I jogged in place in interview A. I'd been in this room now for 12 hours, slept for a few of them, and sat for the rest, until I realized that my brain was in danger of atrophying along with my muscles. If I hoped to have any shot at matching wits with Ingram Barrett, I had to keep my blood flowing. So I ran for an hour, did jumping jacks and burpees, and was just cooling down when Detective Cruz entered the room. Oh, he stopped short. Sorry. I was standing on one leg, with the other stretched out behind me in an arabesque. He looked embarrassed, as if he'd caught me flossing, or worse. I lowered my leg to the floor and stood up straight. Just trying to keep my blood circulating, I said.
Sure, I get it.
Something seemed to have changed again. His eyes were once more soft, and his lip no longer curled into the sneer he'd worn during our last session. He held up his arms. He had a big paper bag in one hand and a small paper bag in the other. The aroma of grilled meat was floating out of one of them.
I brought you some lunch, he said, and some clothes from your apartment.
Oh, thank you. I couldn't say which one made me happier. He handed me the bags. I wanted to tear into the food, but not while he was standing there. I took a peek inside the larger bag.
I don't know if I brought the right clothes.
He shifted uncomfortably.
They were in the hallway outside your apartment.
I nodded. That was where I'd last seen them. Inside the bag were a sweater, jeans, socks, a bra and panties. I looked up at him. He had the grace to blush.
I brought some shoes, too.
My running shoes were in the bottom of the bag. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're still free to go, you know.
I know, but you know why.
Yeah, I know.
He nodded toward the bag of clothes.
Sorry, I couldn't find a coat.
That's all right. The only coat I owned was in his evidence lockup. It's plenty warm in here.
You may not be here much longer, though.
My gaze sharpened. Oh?
Looks like your story checks out. Your key card was in your bag, like you said.
Thank you for checking.
And, your prints aren't on those resumes. Nobody's are.
Ah, I said, like somebody wore gloves. He nodded.
We just need to nail down the source of the gun, and we can wrap this up.
I see. I thought a moment. Can't you run it through that federal database? What's it called?
IBIS, and we already did. The gun's never been used in any reported incident.
Oh.
And the maker of the DIY kit sold thousands of them, but none to Lucy Barton Jones.
Or to me.
Or to you.
So what else can you do? He hesitated, as if wondering how much more he could share with me, then went ahead.
We're searching her house this afternoon, looking for a gun safe or ammo, or even some metalworking tools.
All the things you didn't find in my apartment.
Right. But what if you don't find them in her house either? He didn't answer. He turned to the door and put his hand on the knob, but he stopped there.
Even if we don't?
He said without looking back. He spoke barely above a whisper, and I knew he was confiding something he shouldn't.
It looks like we found her suicide note.
He seemed to regret the words as soon as he spoke them. He wrenched the door open and hurried from the room. I sat stunned after he was gone. Lucy left a suicide note? She actually did mean to kill herself? Wow.
Chapter 18. I can't do this anymore. Lucy's text had landed last night while Barrett was out to dinner with two other couples. He'd glanced at it on his lap while Melanie harangued the waiter about the carb count of every item on the menu. Then he'd pocketed his phone and resumed perusing the wine list. It never occurred to him that this meant her life. His conscience was clear on that point. At the time, it was the any more that puzzled him. Because it was already done. He wasn't asking her to do any more than to keep her mouth shut about it. He needed to have another conversation with her, obviously. But at the time, it also seemed obvious that it could wait until Monday morning. Now, though, looking at the readout of the text synced through to Ma Bell, he had to wonder, should he have realized? Could he have prevented this awful tragedy? It was a terrible loss, and he allowed himself a brief moment to mourn her. It may have been a stretch when he'd told the police she was a dear friend, but there was no question she was a valuable employee. There couldn't have been a more perfect interface with the company's wide and varied workforce. Her familiarity with Asian culture made her someone the factory workers could relate to. Her upper-crust British accent was all it took to intimidate the creatives and keep them in line. And her no-nonsense efficiency was everything the admins wanted in an HR director. If only she'd been a little less fastidious. He mourned that as well. The whole admin team was currently mourning her in an impromptu gathering and reception. CEO Phil Duval was making one of his rare visits to Marketplace Tower, and when he sent out an office-wide blast that he'd be receiving in reception, everyone felt entitled to abandon their work and flock around him like he was laying on hands or something. Barrett stayed in his office, door closed, and watched the proceedings on CCTV. By all rights, Duval's office should have been here in the admin headquarters. Not only because he was CEO, but because the accounting office was here, and Duval was also the fucking CFO. But he preferred to maintain his office with the creatives on 7th Avenue, and another one in Tour, so he could liaise with Madame. He liked to dress like the creatives, one day in a turtleneck and beret, another in a dashiki and gladiator sandals. Today, for his visit to the hinterlands, he wore a tweed jacket and a pair of voluminous plus fours, as if golfing in the 20s or shooting pheasants in Derbyshire. Barrett watched the Ma Bell screen as Duval swanned around the employees, doling out two-grip handshakes and pressing forehead to forehead as if he could ease their grief with the power of his touch. Now and then, he pasted on a brave smile and posed for selfies, introducing himself to everyone as Philippe, when Barrett knew for a fact that the name on his birth certificate was Philip. He even sported a little French mustache with waxed tips, like he was some kind of maitre d'. Most of the admin employees recognized him for the phony he was, but they treated him like visiting royalty. He was their only living conduit to Madame de Martineau. She might preside over the board meetings by telephone. Audio only, no video hookup. Vanity, thy name is former supermodel. But she otherwise saw no one, spoke to no one, except Duval. He was her official gatekeeper. No one, including Barrett, much to his resentment, could speak to Madame directly. Everything had to be funneled through Duval. Rumor had it that they'd once been lovers. A rumor Duval did nothing to dispel. If true, it made him the only man in history to sleep his way to the top. At least, the only straight man. At any rate, it worked. He started out as an accountant for Madame's fledgling design firm. A decade ago, she made him CFO, and 5 years later, she named him as her successor. Today, he held the titles of president, CEO, and CFO, though they were titles in name and comp packages only. Everyone in admin knew it was Barrett who was doing all the heavy lifting in this operation. The video feed on his Ma Bell screen showed Duval heading this way. Barrett must be the last whistle stop on the papal tour.
Mr. Duval's here,
Marcia announced through the speaker as the office door swung in.
Barry,
Duval cried with a big shit-eating smile on his plump, chinless face.
Phil,
Barrett jumped up and met him for a handshake that they both held for 30 seconds too long.
Just wanted to say hello.
So glad you did. Coffee?
No, no, can't linger.
Under the tweed jacket, Duval wore a waistcoat and a woolen tie. Barrett stole a glance down, expecting to find wellies on his feet. But no, only a pair of sturdy leather brogues.
Just wanted to pop in and check that all's well.
Glad you did.
That brouhaha last night,
that's all taken care of, is it?
In progress, Barrett said, tight-lipped.
In fact, the detectives are on their way over here now to review a few details. Be great if you could join us.
No, no, wouldn't want to step on your toes. Anyway, I'm afraid I have to be going. Off to tour tonight.
Give my best to Madame.
Yes, yes, and give my love to Andrea, won't you?
Andrea was Barrett's first wife, divorced 8 years ago.
I sure will, he said.
Barrett seethed for a full 10 minutes after he left.
That brouhaha.
As if Lucy's death were some kind of minor dust-up. He knew Duval's game. By downplaying the whole thing, he thought he could maintain his plausible deniability. As if such a thing existed. If Barrett went down, so would Duval. He was the one who got Madame de Martineau's blessing for the scheme. And he was the one who massaged the numbers to make it work, and Barrett had him on tape confirming all of the above. Or rather, on a digital voice recording that was now tucked into Barrett's wall safe at home under the cash and jewelry.
The detectives have arrived, Mr. Barrett, Marcia's voice came through the speaker. Mr. Culligan's assistant has shown them to the theater.
Ma Bell, show me the theater,
Barrett commanded the box on his desk. And instantly, the screen lit up with a shot of the auditorium on 29. Detectives Riley and Cruz were waiting there, as he'd instructed. They were sitting in the front row, their butts sunk deep into the plush, upholstered chairs. But they'd resisted any temptation to recline them. Their seat backs were in the locked and upright position. Riley's eyes were closed, and they both looked like they were dead on their asses. They'd have to be, after 15 hours on this case, and without the benefit of the fear-induced adrenaline that was keeping Barrett alert. By now, they'd be desperate to wrap this up. They'd be willing to accept any reasonable theory. Time to check in on Culligan.
Ma Bell, show me backstage left, he said, and the video cut to Jack Culligan waiting in the wings.
His lips were moving soundlessly, and beads of sweat dotted his forehead. He looked like he was rehearsing his lines. He was too nervous, and Barrett worried that he might be the next weak link in the chain. He'd need close watching.
Ma Bell, connect me to Jack Culligan.
Barrett watched as Culligan pressed the wire at his ear and the call connected.
All set, Jack?
All set.
On my way.
He went downstairs and joined Culligan backstage.
Go ahead, he said.
And Culligan pushed a button that lowered the Jumbotron screen at the front of the stage. They entered from stage left.
Gentlemen, Barrett said, as Riley shook himself awake.
Mr. Barrett, Cruz called up, we'd like a word alone.
Of course, whatever you need.
But first, Jack has something to show you.
Culligan stepped forward.
When we met this morning, you asked us for the rest of our internal surveillance from last night. And for the hard drives off their computers. We've pulled all that together for you. But there are a couple things we want to highlight. Let's start with Ms. Lambert's movements after she left Ms. Barton Jones's office. These clips track her back to her own office. Barrett and Culligan moved to the opposite wings of the stage as the house lights dimmed and a video began to play on the screen. The first sequence was the same clip they'd shown the detectives earlier. The one with Shay Lambert coming out of Lucy's office and clapping her hands over her teary face. But now it was magnified 50 times. Now they could see not only that Lambert was crying, but that her whole body was trembling. We saw this already, Cruz called up to the stage. Culligan nodded. Now watch as she comes around the corner. Another camera was activated as Lambert came into view. The timestamp on this clip read 20:40:32, about 4 minutes after the previous clip. She seemed to be walking in a normal gait in this one, with no obvious sign of distress. And here she is, coming into the corridor toward her own office. The timestamp said 20:43:06, and she was striding purposefully, her shoulders back and her chin high. The camera followed her down the hall to an open office door. She went through, and although there was no audio on the footage, it looked very much like she slammed the door. Culligan played three more time-stamped clips. Lambert emerging from her office 10 minutes later, striding down the corridor, and rounding the corner to the elevator. Now I'll show you Ms. Barton Jones's movements. This video clip showed the door to Lucy's office opening, and Lucy pulling on her coat as she came out. She turned and locked the door behind her. Another clip with another timestamp jump showed her turning a corner and walking down the corridor. And the final one showed her turning into the elevator bank. You've already seen the elevator surveillance, I believe, Culligan said, but for the sake of continuity, I'll play that now. The screen cut to the elevator bank and the image of Lucy's back as Lambert came up beside her. Lambert spoke some soundless words and turned to face the elevator. The doors opened and both women stepped on. The next clip they'd also seen before. The two women standing inside the elevator. Lucy's face was a mask of horror. Then the screen went blank. That look on her face. Barrett came out of the wings to stand silhouetted before the white screen. I've never seen her look so scared. Obviously, she was terrified of Lambert and what she might do. Then why'd she get on the elevator with her? Cruz said. Who knows? A desire to maintain normalcy no matter the situation? Whatever, she soon regretted it. We'll need the raw footage. Barrett nodded at Culligan, who trotted down the stairs on the side of the stage and handed Cruz a large manila envelope. In there, you'll find a flash drive with the video footage, along with affidavits establishing authenticity and chain of custody, Barrett said. You'll also find flash drives containing the non-privileged contents of Lucy's computer, and the same thing for Lambert. Meanwhile, I want to draw your particular attention to this document that we found on Lucy's computer. The screen lit up again with a supersized image of a form. It was a CDMI form, with the white dove logo in the upper left corner. Notice of termination was the pre-printed heading. Barrett used a laser pointer to highlight the first field. Lambert's name was typed into that box. Next, he pointed to the either-or boxes farther down. Without cause and with cause. The second box had an X filled in. Below that was a blank for grounds. And the field was filled in with the words, falsified employment history. Barrett ran the laser to the bottom of the form, where there was a line for employee acknowledgement. It was blank. Below that was a notation that employee declined to sign. He highlighted that for a long moment before he turned back to his audience. She was combative. She left in tears. But by the time she returned to her own office, you can see her resolve in her posture. She wasn't going out like a lamb. I got a question, Cruz called from his seat. For you, I guess, Mr. Culligan. Doesn't company policy state that a terminated employee has to be escorted off the premises by security? Culligan glanced at Barrett before he answered. It does. So why didn't you have a security officer on site? It was Sunday. Super Bowl Sunday. No one was on duty, and Lucy said it wouldn't be necessary, Barrett put in.
Uh-huh,
Cruz said, obviously not buying it.
Doesn't company policy also state that terminated employees must surrender their key cards?
Yes. And Lambert still had hers.
Barrett answered again.
Lucy's assistant was in charge of collecting the cards. She wasn't in the office last night, obviously, and I expect Lucy simply overlooked it.
That's it? Mistakes were made?
What can I say, Detective? These policies are written in a vacuum for an idealized, perfect situation. In real life, mistakes are made. But you can see what happened. She was terminated, she refused to sign, she refused to surrender her key card. She was clearly hostile.
And Ms. Barton-Jones was clearly suicidal.
Barrett scoffed. That's ridiculous.
Her husband confirms it. She'd been anxious about something for a while. She was taking Xanax. She was especially upset last night. So upset that he was frantically trying to reach her. But she wouldn't take his calls or answer his texts.
Barrett shrugged. That could mean anything.
What does it mean to say, I can't do this anymore?
Slowly, Barrett came down off the stage. You were referring to the text she sent me last night.
That's right. And if you'd like to do this in private...
Cruz nodded in Culligan's direction. No, Jack can stay. He's already acquainted with these facts. As I told you this morning, I directed Lucy to fire Lambert last night. I wanted her gone before the office opened this morning. Lucy was reluctant, I admit it. She wanted to open an investigation, give Lambert a chance to defend herself, paper up the file. But I wasn't worried about blowback. Lambert wouldn't dare sue us with that bald-faced lie on her resume. Lucy didn't like doing it that way, though. It didn't sit right with her. If she was upset about anything last night, that's what it was. Now that I think of it, that's probably why she forgot to get the key card back. In any event, that's what she meant when she said, I can't do this anymore.
You can't know that.
In fact, I can. She spoke the identical words to me on the phone earlier when I told her to fire Lambert.
But she said she can't do this anymore. Like this wasn't an isolated case. This was something ongoing.
Barrett acknowledged it with a grim shrug. Not ongoing, exactly. But it happened once before, with another young lawyer I wanted gone. That was on a weekend, too, and Lucy wasn't happy about the way that was done, either.
Why'd you fire that one?
Another case of resume fraud? Barrett scowled at the jibe. That one wasn't willing to do the work. Look, I'm a tough taskmaster. I make no apologies.
He took a breath and let his expression relax.
But I did apologize to Lucy. I told her I wouldn't ask her to do it this way again. After this, I'd follow protocol. She sent me that text to let me know she'd be holding me to that promise.
The detectives looked at each other.
Interesting spin. Riley hauled himself to his feet. Let me give you another one.
Barrett spread his arms wide,
like, take your best shot. Ms. Barton-Jones was having an affair. With you, Mr. Barrett. And the guilt was eating her up.
Barrett barked a laugh.
He wished he had that superpower now. He'd freeze this scene until he could work it out.
He had to wonder if that wouldn't have been a better play all around. It would have given Lucy a reason for suicide that had nothing to do with business. No one would go digging for any other skeletons in her closet if they could write this all off as a sex scandal. And it would have been a solution that didn't require the sacrifice of Shay Lambert.
But manufacturing an affair? He couldn't do that to Melanie. Not in their no-prenup marriage. And there was even the risk that the board might demand his resignation. No, better to stick to the course they were on.
That's absurd, he said.
She was popping Xanax like breath mints, Riley said. She was ducking her husband's calls. The guilt was eating her up.
That's ridiculous, Barrett said. Lucy was the consummate professional. Everything about her was above reproach.
You can ask anyone.
Oh, we will, Riley said. You can count on it.
Barrett shrugged.
Fine.
But it's Lambert's friends and family you really should be talking to.
She doesn't have any family, Cruz piped up.
Barrett raised an eyebrow.
Is that what she told you?
The detectives exchanged a glance.
Ah, I see. Jack?
Barrett snapped his fingers, and Culligan came down off the stage with a folder in his hands.
Our security team does a background check on each of our new hires.
Jack's handing you a copy of what he found on Lambert.
Take a look, gentlemen, he said,
as Culligan handed the folder to Cruz.
She's not who she says she is.
Chapter 19. February 2nd, 2014. The lights flashed on in the apartment. David was back. He was tearing through the dresser drawers. He was hauling armloads of clothes out of the drawers and dumping them out in the hallway. My clothes. I bolted upright in bed. David, what are you doing? He wheeled on me. I want you out of here. Get up. Get out. He took my suit off the hook and flung it out into the hall. David, please, stop. He stooped to sneer in my face. God, you make me sick. It makes me sick to look at you. I couldn't tell whether he was desperate for a fix or he'd already had one. I scrabbled away from him, backward on the collapsing mattress. I wish I'd never married you. I wish I'd never met you. You ruined my life. I had everything going for me, everything. And then you came along, acting like you were gonna be somebody, amount to something. But you were nothing but a loser, a total loser. And you've done nothing but drag me down with you. David, no, sweetheart, you acted like you were going places, but that's all it was, an act. You're nothing but a fraud. But I have a job again. We're going to be okay now. A job, he sneered. You think you're something, you and your job. But you're nothing but a worker bee, a little insignificant worker bee, a peon, a wage slave. That's all you are. Even so, it's a start. We can build from here. We can get our feet back under us. Don't you fucking hear me? He yelled. There is no we. He lunged across the bed and dragged me off the mattress and across the littered floor of the apartment. I struggled to stand up, and he grabbed the front of my t-shirt and almost lifted me off my feet. I was startled by the power in his grip, that he had that much strength left in him. You get out and never come back. You hear me? Never come back. He shoved me into the hall, and I landed sprawling on the pile of clothes. He slammed the door and shot the deadbolt with a hollow thud. The door across the hall cracked open, and a single eye peeped out at me. Sorry, I whispered. You want I call the cops? No, everything's fine. The door closed. I rummaged frantically through the heap of clothes until I found my purse and briefcase. I checked inside. My cash was gone, but I was relieved to find that everything else was there. I rose to my knees. David? I whispered through the keyhole. I knocked softly and whispered his name again. And when he didn't answer, I pressed my forehead to the door. David, please let me in. No response. David, please. We can fight this together. When his voice finally sounded, it was also through the keyhole, and as soft as mine.
I hope you die, he said.
I sank back on the pile of clothes. He was out of his mind on drugs. He couldn't mean it. I looked around bleakly. I didn't know what time it was, very late or very early. People might soon be stirring. I couldn't stay here, but I didn't know where else to go. I had nowhere to go. No, I remembered. As long as I had a job, I had somewhere to go. I stood up and hoped that no one else would crack their door open in the next 5 minutes. I peeled off my t-shirt and rooted through the heap on the floor for underwear and a blouse.
then put on my suit skirt and jacket. My rail pass was still in my wallet. My key card was still in there. I could get to the office, the only place left in the world to go. It was a Sunday, and so early that I had the office to myself. I made a fresh pot of coffee and searched for any food that might be left over from Friday, but there was nothing. The vending machine was stocked up, and the candy bars and chips and crackers were tantalizing through the glass. But without money, that was where they had to remain. Lester wasn't scheduled to come in today, and I didn't have any work to do that wasn't in the lab. I played solitaire on my computer. I read the news online. I read about Operation Super Bowl and the arrests of 30 sex traffickers and the rescue of 70 victim workers. I read about a typhoon in the South China Sea and the feared loss of an entire Thai fishing fleet. I did the Times crossword, anything to keep from thinking, to keep from hearing those ugly words, loser, worker bee, wage slave. I never would have married you. I hate you. I hope you die. They ricocheted inside my head. One phrase kept haunting me. You act like you're something, but it's all just an act. Because that much was true. It had always been true. I worked another puzzle. I read another news website. I went for a stroll around the perimeter of the 30th floor, then kicked off my shoes and turned it into a run. I ran lap after dizzying lap, but it was no use. I couldn't drown out the words in my head. Work. Work would occupy me more than any of these attempted distractions. I unlocked my desk drawer and took out my notes on the PST asset sales. I started to plug the numbers into an Excel spreadsheet, but I realized that anyone in the company could access it through the server, so I deleted all of it and wrote it out on a legal pad. In the first column, I put a shorthand description of the asset sold. In the second column, I recorded the actual price received. And in the third column, I wrote the falsified price that was on the documents in the lab. I filled pages after pages with the data. And when I was done, I totaled up the difference between the actual and the recorded prices. The delta was over $20 million. $20 million worth of drug money masquerading as asset realization. $20 million worth of drugs going into addicts' bodies and destroying their lives. And here I was, working for the people responsible for such devastation, and grateful for the chance. David was right. I was pathetic. I went online again and logged on to lawjobs.com. It was a site I used to visit twice a day, sometimes all day, continuously refreshing the page in hopes that something new would be posted, and that if I were the first to see it, I might somehow ensure that the job was mine. I'd hoped those days were behind me forever, but here I was again, desperately scanning the job postings for something, anything, that would get me out of here. It was late in the day when I spotted my ideal job. I was weak with hunger by then, and bleary-eyed from a day of staring at the computer screen. So at first, I thought I might have hallucinated it. I couldn't be seeing right. I blinked hard to clear my vision, but it was still there when I looked again. My ideal job. I was perfect for it. I knew that because it was the job I currently held. The posting was identical to the one I applied for last fall. CDMI had reposted my job. Ingram Barrett was replacing me. I was a piece of single-use plastic, to be disposed of after the single use was over. Barrett couldn't risk having me around after my project was done. Even if I never figured out the drug connection, I might let something slip inadvertently. Better just to let me go and count on the non-disclosure agreement to keep me silent. So he'd told Lucy Barton Jones to find a replacement, and she'd posted the job. Everything David said was true. I was nothing, less than nothing. A worker bee, a wage slave, fungible, disposable.
human capital to be exploited, human resources to be mined like ore until the vein was exhausted. I lost a few hours after that. I may have fallen asleep in my chair, or passed out from hunger, or simply zoned out. But when I came to, it was after 8, and the top of Marketplace Tower was shrouded with fog. I would miss the last train out if I didn't leave soon, though I had no idea where to go. I reached into the desk drawer for my purse. Beneath it were the air charter contracts I'd squirreled away weeks ago. I couldn't remember what had bothered me about them, but there was something, and I took them out now and read them through again. They were all signed on behalf of CDMI by Lucy Barton Jones, Director of Human Resources, and the passenger manifests listed a total of 1,800 names on 6 flights. I recognized some of the names, many of them, from the database of employee names I'd created in the lab. One of the chartered flights carried the underage workers I'd flagged earlier, and that discovery prompted me to scan through all the names on the manifests. The passengers were divided by age and gender. 2 flights carried men only. 2 carried women over 40. The last 2 carried the younger women and children. That struck me as strange. I wondered if it was some religious thing. I looked back at my charts, showing the inflated asset sales, then back at the flight manifests. The inflated numbers and the passenger names scrolled through my mind in intersecting loops. Then the loops lined up into parallel reels, and they started to spin like the symbols displayed in a slot machine, until one by one they clicked to a stop and lined up to spell it out. My breath caught in my chest like a fist squeezing. The asset sales weren't inflated to conceal drug revenues. It was never about drugs. It was worse than drugs. It was 1,800 times worse. I sat frozen with horror. I couldn't say how long. Those words rang inside my head again. Worker bees, wage slaves, fungible, disposable. We were all the same. I had the proof. And slowly I pulled myself together enough to put it into a chronology that told the whole story. I labeled the contracts with post-it notes numbered 1 through 6. I labeled the table of sales figures as number 7. Then I slid the documents into my battered briefcase and grabbed my coat. A hush swelled through the penthouse corridors as I made my way to the elevator, broken only by the abiding hum of the building's mechanicals. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know where I could go. But my feet kept moving. It was like I was sleepwalking or in a dream. A nightmare. I arrived at the elevator bank. Someone else was waiting there. And as I came up beside her, I saw that it was Lucy Barton Jones, Director of Human Resources. Director of Human Trafficking. I stared at her. "I know what you did," I said. The center elevator arrived. The cage door opened. We stepped on. I reached into my bag, and her face froze in a mask of horror when she saw what I brought out. Everything stopped. Darkness descended. Chapter 20. 4 hours passed before the door to Interview A swung in again, and instantly I could see that something had changed since I last saw the detectives. Riley now wore a stubble of beard that was shockingly white against the gray pallor of his skin. Cruz's Van Dyke was neatly trimmed again. He must have kept a razor in his desk. But it was their expressions that had changed the most. "What?" I said. "What happened?" They might have struck out on their search of Lucy's house, but they still had the note. That should have been enough. Cruz didn't answer or even look at me. He sat down and turned on the recording equipment, and he droned out all the preliminaries again. Date and time, persons in the room, consents and waivers duly executed. Riley ignored my question too.
"Hold up," he said to Cruz.
You just said Shay Lambert's in the room. Oh, you're right, Cruz agreed. Let me correct that for the record. I should have said Sharona Chance.
He looked at me then, finally.
Isn't that right?
He said. And he opened a folder and shot a paper across the table like a hockey puck. I didn't need to look at it. I knew what it was. As soon as he said Sharona Chance, I knew they'd gotten their hands on my birth certificate. The name was Barb's little dig against the man who'd knocked her up. My Sharona was their song, and Fat Chance was the name she gave him after he took off, and she found out he wasn't really Paul Getty. It was a stupid name, I said. I never used it. You can call yourself whatever you want, Mrs. Casco told me. So starting in eighth grade, I signed all my tests and homework papers as Shay Chance. The school eventually conformed my transcripts, and by the time I reached law school, I made it legal. Later, I switched out Chance for Lambert and made that legal, too. A birth certificate wasn't a public record in the state of New York. No one was ever supposed to see it.
Makes you wonder, doesn't it? Riley said. About the kind of person who'd kill off her own mother?
We were never close, I said in a low voice. We didn't have any kind of relationship.
Yeah, so we gathered, Cruz said. That call you made to her on Christmas Day was the first time she'd heard from you in years.
They'd opened my phone. They'd talked to Barb.
She told us a lot more than that, he said. Things that make us wonder if you told us anything that's true.
I have.
Poor me, I'm an only child, he said in a falsetto.
She'd told them about Roger and Tommy. They're half-brothers, I said. They're a lot older than I am. I barely knew them.
Or maybe you deliberately withheld their names because Roger's doing time in a federal penitentiary.
No, I didn't know that. We haven't been in touch for years.
You'll never guess what he was convicted of.
During the few years when I knew him, he was arrested for public drunkenness, retail theft, auto theft, and assault. I have no idea, I said.
Illegal firearms sales, Cruz said. And you'll never guess what kind.
I stared at him.
Ghost guns. Homemade. From DIY kits he bought online.
No, I didn't even know what they were until you...
From the same manufacturer as the gun that killed Lucy Barton Jones.
I shook my head. I haven't seen or heard from him in almost 20 years. I don't know anything about any ghost guns.
You brought the gun onto that elevator, Cruz said.
No.
You'd just been fired, Riley said.
My head swiveled his way. No. Cruz, your marriage was over. Riley, and there you are trapped with the woman who fired you. Cruz, when the lights go out. Riley, it wasn't Barton Jones who snapped. Cruz, it was you. I was spinning between the two of them, shaking my head wildly at each accusation. No, no, it was Lucy. Cruz pushed back from the table.
Stand up.
What? He came around behind me. No, honestly, you're making a terrible mistake. He grabbed me and pulled me to my feet and jerked my arms behind me.
Sharona Chance Lambert, you are under arrest for the murder of Lucy Barton Jones.
I felt the cold snap of handcuffs around my wrists.